Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's April the 9th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. This is Andy Donner. As our longtime listener base will remember, I've asked that the whole white nationalist movement deep six its obsession with bad news porn. However, a very interesting trend has manifested itself in a set of national news stories, which we would do well to take notice of. Harold recently sent out a link to an item which detailed how whites are fleeing New Jersey and immigrants are replacing them. Now that I'm actually getting around to talking about this, I'm kicking myself for not taking better notes of what and when, but the last month or so has also seen a string of news items aggregated by the Drudge Report, which more or less lay out the reality of white genocide in plain Wigger-friendly language. And I don't just mean the typical sort of Republican whining about we need to take back the country or whatever. All of this stuff was open anti-white activity on the part of the government and other entities. It was your standard, white people aren't allowed to do this, non-white people are getting away with that, and so forth. My personal favorite was a story about an initiative in the technology industry called Code 2040, which is a program intended to make sure white people, and a smattering of Asians, aren't the only ones capable of operating technology or running the technology sector, because soon there aren't going to be very many young whites. And soon after that, no whites at all. Okay, maybe Drudge isn't exactly a mainstream news source, but the people who go there are the most likely to be able to think as we do, if given the right nudges. This is actually pretty important, because white nationalists pride themselves on knowing things. Not on accomplishments or other admirable traits, such as their character, but on merely knowing things. The bad news porn epidemic in our movement is the mechanism by which we prove how much we know, and therefore how much of a white nationalist we are. And the use of words on the internet and stupid signs on the street, as opposed to action to stop white genocide, is how we accumulate our reputation in the movement. Start a useless pseudo-intellectual blog, and all of a sudden, you're a so-called leader. Doubly so if you oppose the one viable path our white race has remaining, which would actually allow it to survive past the next few decades. I'm sure most of the audience remembers the cartoon character Yogi Bear and his favorite self-promotional catchphrase.
I'm smarter than the average bear.
Due to all of these mainstream news stories, which are blatantly racial, including the Starbucks racial discussion nonsense, you all out there are not smarter than the average Wigger. You heard that right. Aside from a few details, most of the population is largely caught up with you. And yes, I really do mean that. It wasn't especially hard for them, since, as a whole, white nationalists are sitting on nothing more than a few facts. At this point in time, your average Wigger has just as much practice at being white nationalist as the average white nationalist. And unlike most white nationalists, I'm not just talking for the sake of talk. This actually matters. In effect, all of white nationalism, except those involved with the Northwest Front, have the same effect on the world as the average Wigger. That's got to change. The average Wigger actually has about as much of an idea of what to do about their concerns, as most white nationalists, too. In case you're not getting me here, I'll be plain. As time goes on, white nationalism, outside the Northwest Front, looks more and more like general Wiggerdom, such that the gap barely exists at this late date. Any of you could, at any point you so decided, actually do something with all of these seemingly helpful racial facts you've collected over the years. I've been reminded just this week that there are actually several others around the homeland who regularly take the time to meet new incomers as well as those on their scouting trips. I know because I'm sometimes made privy to their assessments of those they meet. And meet they do. More and more, white nationalists are opting to overthrow their inner Wigger and take care of business. You should too. Hail victory, comrades.
I figured I'd let Andy go first this week. Right, I want to talk now about a topic which is of, I'd say, middling to high importance in our wee little movement, although it's a subject we generally tend to avoid because, like so many of the topics we avoid or should avoid, it tends to generate heat rather than light. And more often than not, it turns out to be one of those big sound and fury deals that all the little white boys on the internet use as an excuse to go off into a corner and sulk and not do anything at all, to retreat back into words from whatever tentative real-world action we might have been about to take. Isn't it odd how these weird little ideological disputes of the how many stormtroopers can dance on the head of a pin variety that are of such terrible vital importance that we must absolutely resolve them now, isn't it odd how they always seem to occur when someone is on the verge of actually doing something that might make the dictatorship mad for real and cause people in expensive suits with badges to start showing up on doorsteps? It's as if we are all subconsciously seeking some legitimate or at least quasi-legitimate excuse to pull back, to half-step, to not take that first peep out from behind the computer where somebody might see our faces, to not do that bit of long-distance driving in order to meet someone and take this off the internet and back into the real world, so forth and so on. We will grab on to any excuse to jump back into the dense brush of the internet and hide. One of those excuses being, oh, I can't work with so-and-so. He said something I disagree with on a blog. Okay, I'll get on with it. Recently, the owner and webmaster of a pretty well-known white nationalist website, which I will not name, but which most of you will be familiar with, took the unusually forthright step of basically banning women from his site. Now, as I understand it, and this is ongoing, so by the time you hear this, things may have changed, women are still allowed to post comments to articles, but they're not allowed to contribute articles or to appear as guests or co-hosts on podcasts. I gather this whole thing came up because one of this guy's podcasters had a female co-host on one week, and the webmaster protested, and it developed into an argument, and the guy either quit the website or else he was thrown off. That's never clear in these situations. This webmaster came right out and said in the article that in his view we need to return to medieval times, and women should be kept around for housekeeping, cooking, childbearing, and recreational purposes, and as far as white nationalism goes, they should just be seldom seen and never heard because they are all too badly damaged in their minds by feminism, and they're useless and counterproductive and cause more trouble than they're worth. Now, many of you will know what website I'm talking about, and I have to say that of our wee little movement's public outreach efforts, this is definitely one of the best. The site is well-designed and maintained, updated every day, the content is top-notch, the webmaster appears to be an older man with a track record of actual, real-world accomplishment, although I admit I don't know that much about him. And so it's not as if we're talking about some kid named Jason living in his brother's basement and playing with his computer when he's not driving around delivering pizzas for 20 hours a week. What this man thinks and says actually carries some weight in our wee little slice of life. The women question itself actually does have some importance because it's going to affect how our movement develops, both here in the Northwest and everywhere else. So I think that since the controversy on this site has raised the question, I need to go ahead and put myself on record on the whole women thing. And no, I won't read that one section from A Mighty Fortress. That needs to be read, not listened to. I will try to keep this as short and as concise as I can. Like I say, this is a topic which tends to generate heat rather than light, and the more conversation about it, the more heat is generated. I think my Northwest novels speak for themselves. They're replete with genuinely strong female characters like Nightshade and Rooney Wingfield and Annette Ridgway and Betsy in Freedom's Sons, and also female characters that develop true strength in the course of the plot action like Kiki McGee and Georgia Myers. Many people of both genders have told me down through the years that that's one of the things they like best about the books. They like my female characters and the way I handle them. One of the worst misconceptions we have is that being a woman of strong character and ability automatically equals a left-wing feminist, and that simply isn't true. I've tried to show that in my books, and that is the attitude I take in real life. Strength of character is strength of character. Feminism is a political and sexual perversion of reality. The two are not the same. A woman can be strong, or she can be a bitch. Those aren't the same either. The best way I ever heard it put was back in the 1970s by one of our women comrades. Someone asked Rita if she was into women's liberation, as it was called back then, and she said, "No, I'm into my liberation." Now, all of that having been said, yes, I can understand why so many white nationalist men have a problem with white women. Now, let's lay this on the line. I think pretty much all of us have had hideous, terrible experiences with white women who turned out to be damaged goods. Far more damaged than we at first realized. Some of you may remember that I haven't always exactly batted 1,000 myself along that line. Not just white nationalist men, white men in general, and yes, as a result of constant problems, trouble, and mistreatment at the hands of women, there is a lot of just plain flat-out misogyny out there, as well as a lot of hysterical man-hating on the part of women. This is because of the way that we've been forced to live our lives by left-wing and Jewish political correctness. Men can no longer be men, and women can no longer be women. It's not allowed. The woman who chooses to get married and stay at home and raise a family in this day and age, she is the truly strong woman, because she's making a choice that this society rejects her right to make. There's a flip side to that. The increasingly rarest hen's teeth man who has a secure job wherein he earns enough money to support such a wife and family at home, he is an enemy of political correctness and Obama's America as well, because he's not supposed to exist at all. Now tell me, do you think the Obama depression has just happened? Do you think this business of 93 million Americans not employed in the workforce, the overwhelming majority of them white and the majority of those white males, is an accident? No. It is a deliberate policy on the part of the dictatorship to make everyone dependent on government and hence the Democratic Party for their sustenance. Black women have been living without men for generations, supported by welfare and food stamps and aid to dependent families and so forth and so on. More government cash with every black baby they drop, every one of them either a future slave laborer in the prison industrial complex or else a future Democrat voter. Most likely both. Now it's white people's turn to have our family structure destroyed by liberal democracy in preparation for the one world state, with a 1-2 whammy of feminism and Obama depression. The undeniable fact is that many white women, beginning with my own generation, have been terribly and irredeemably damaged by the poisonous atmosphere which has prevailed in this country since about 1961, when cultural Marxism began moving into the mainstream. They have been denied fulfillment as women and forced to masculinize themselves in order to survive. Because these days, they're going to get thrown into the workforce at age 21 with a $75,000 student loan debt just like white boys. More so, because fewer and fewer white boys are even admitted to college every year. The pressure that young white women face to stay thin as rails and always to be quote-unquote hot and to have it all and do it all and live up to the Wonder Woman stereotype and above all be the dominant person in all their male relationships is crushing. And it drives many white girls just plain batshit. The fact is undeniable that many, and yes, in my opinion, probably most white women out there today are damaged goods, at least to one degree or another. And by the way, white men aren't in much better shape, but I really don't want to take up this whole podcast on this topic, so I'll drag myself kicking and screaming back to the point. As to more or less forcing women back into the kitchen, the nursery, and the bedroom, as this webmaster is advocating, look, I understand the kind of anger and hurt and bitterness that can cause a man like that to take that kind of attitude. And I can understand it as well as a theoretical and ideological principle as to how white culture needs to be structured and needs to function. I mean, after all, that's more or less how we functioned for thousands of years, up until about 50 years ago, and that division of labor between the sexes got us where we are today. I get what this webmaster is saying. However, I don't think it's very practical. And we in our wee little movement need rapidly to get a very pragmatic attitude about all of this. As far as shoving women back into the kitchen and the nursery and the bedroom, the fact is, guys, that ship has pretty much sailed for any kind of future we can realistically foresee. We have to start learning to deal with the world as it is and with our people as they are. Now, those of you who have received the last Northwest Front organizational letter and the April issue of Northwest Observer will be aware that the party is starting to make some changes along that line ourselves. One of the comments on that website about all of the stuff I read, I think really sums it up well. If white men want our women to come back to us, then we need to begin displaying strength, power, and dominance again. If we want our women to respect us and come to us as companions and friends and partners, then we white men need to show ourselves worthy of that. Okay, first music break. I have a personal policy that anytime I'm watching a movie or TV show on DVD, which purports to be historical, and I see one bimbo with a sword in her hand, or wearing some kind of armored or metallic lingerie, I just turn the damn thing off. It's false, it's insulting, and it's silly. I don't know what to tell you guys. That bird brain silliness simply didn't happen in the past. When women wanted to stab somebody, they used a dagger. They didn't play D'Artagnan. Now, that does not mean that there were no warrior princesses in the past. There were, like the Lady of Forli I wrote about in the Weird Aryan History series. Now, the woman of yore I am most familiar with, who most closely approaches the Xena warrior princess trope, would be a lady from the 16th century, Grace O'Malley, the pirate queen of Connacht, on the west coast of Ireland, which in those days, when America had just been discovered, was still pretty much the end of the world as far as people knew. In Irish, she's called Gronuala. And for 30 years, she managed to make like Frank Sinatra and do it her way. And she drove a succession of English governors under Queen Elizabeth nutso. This is Rita Connolly from Sean Davies' album Gronuala.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing the myth of the 20th century, and this is a canon of National Socialist literature, and it's by Alfred Rosenberg. This essential work explains how Northern European culture reflects the Nordic soul. And to this end, he discusses philosophy, art, and architecture, but most of all, religion. Now, one problem or prevailing characteristic that Northern Europe has had is that throughout recorded history, it's always been in the shadow of Greece and Rome. Greece is a culture that loved beauty, whereas the Nordic Germanics were more about loyalty, character, and will. And while Goethe is very important in German literature and thought, he's very much enthralled with the idea of the Hellenic as being superior. Now, another thing, of course, is the influence of Rome. Over the centuries, that morphed into the influence of the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholics have always been uncomfortable with the Promethean striving of the Germans. And this author traces that issue all the way back to the Goths, who were initially converted to a type of Christianity called Arianism. And this type of Arianism has nothing to do with ancient India. Rather, it's a form of Christianity that sees Jesus as a man who was a very good man and was a teacher, but was not divine. And this goes all the way up to Pope Pius IX, who declared German nationalism to be demonic. Now, I also think that we see this Roman Catholic influence with regard to Goethe, because, of course, most famously, he did write Faust, which, again, is about the Promethean man who deals with the devil and tries to make some alliance with the devil. And the author does admit that even though he's an enthusiast for Goethe, that Goethe, if alive during the 30s and 40s, would not have supported the cause. Even so, the Nordic will is very much alive, according to this author. And one of the places that we see this is in medieval cathedrals. Because even though they're using stone, which is obviously a very difficult material to work with, they have this upward thrust, and they tend to disappear into the mist. And he sees that as a will to get above this world. Now, another place that we see this Nordic will is in mystic Eckhart, who often spoke of returning to the self. This author declares, even back then, that Christianity is a dead faith, that it's become exhausted. Yes, maybe even back then there were a few that wanted to return to Odinism, but he also says that this is also dead faith, at least in its past form. Now, actually, on this point, I would say he seems rather conflicted. On the one hand, he talks at length about the Catholic and Lutheran history of Germanic Christianity. On the other hand, in other parts of the book, he promotes a ethnic pro-German church. This is very much an eclectic mix of Nordic sagas, Eckhart, Luther, Hellenic influences, and Iranian and Indian philosophy. Now, he wants Jesus to be made over and to be seen as a fiery prophet who throws money changers out of the temple. And it's possible that he wants to make Jesus into something like a Baldar figure. And he has this interesting line in the book where he talks about Jesus taking his place next to the god with a spear, which sounds an awful lot like Odin to me. He does say that Odin is an image of the primal spirit of the Nordics. So this idea of the ethnic church is so eclectic that one wonders if it's entirely coherent. But like Goethe, he's going to ask if an idea bears fruit. in this case, specifically, if it's going to serve the National Socialist goal. To that end, he wants a unity of myth and politics and a new spiritual sustenance for a German-Scandinavian power structure that he sees as coming about. Now, at this point in the book, he goes on to explain how the Reich is going to create a world power that, of course, is based in organic folk states. One of the things they're going to do is contain both China and Islam. And in today's world, that seems a particularly timely desire. Now, he sees World War I as a sacrifice, and that's going to create a new and austere myth. And this collective sacrifice is going to overcome the cultural cycles that Spengler speaks of. And as to the question of the individual versus the universal, they're really two sides of the same coin. Only by acknowledging the organic basis for awareness can we get past this question. Now, without Northern Europe, there's certainly no Northern European religion. One of the things that Paul de Lagarde said, and this is one of the authors or philosophers he speaks of, is that we need a new sun. And he talks about the flag of National Socialism rising triumphant as a prevailing creed. When I try to visualize what the world would have been like had there been the victory of National Socialism, I see a purified world. And it's a world that's not ruled by money or international cutthroat competition or rootlessness. And he talks in this book about the question of unrestrained freedom of movement and how it causes miscegenation. Instead, it's a world where the population is smaller, but it's of better quality. And it has groves and farms, which seem to be a white preoccupation and an ideal in the subconscious, even for the Marxists. Now, if I had the opportunity to speak with a Marxist political soldier, I would ask, what is so beautiful? And granted, that may be a Greek fixation, but at any rate, what is so beautiful about overalls and a widget factory? And why is it good to give all to every angry miscreant on the planet? Getting back to the book itself. One of the things that this book suffers from desperately, and it's really its greatest drawback, is that it has a desperate need for editing. The author goes on and on making the same point over and over. That could easily test a reader's patience. Now, the other thing is that this author is, at some points, comes across as rather a curmudgeon and really spares no criticism. Now, in one section, he does make a lot of misogynistic statements, and whether they are true or false, they're not helpful. Again, both of these things could potentially turn off many readers. Now, it's also helpful to have a knowledge of European philosophy and also art history, some history with regard to German Christianity. And if you don't have that background, there may be certain things that you have to look up to have a better baseline for what the author is talking about. So I can understand if someone picks up this book, tries to read it, and then puts it aside for a time. The other thing is that while Mein Kampf is also long-winded, the difference there is that the personality of Adolf Hitler really comes through in Mein Kampf. Because he had such a wonderful personality, one tends to stick with Mein Kampf. However, in this book, I would say it's more of a challenge. So just be aware of that when you're reading this book. Also realize that this author is clearly an unrepentant Nordicist. So with all those cautions, I thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed my review. And hail victory, comrades.
Greetings, comrades. I figured I'd take y'all up on your offer to talk about our awakening experiences. As I'm sure you can tell, I'm from the South. I'm from a really small town, and unfortunately, it was majority black. Even more unfortunate, I went to a public school system for most of my life. Now, this meant, of course, having to rub shoulders with these apes and quite a few spics on a fairly regular basis. And with this came the quintessential bullying and sometimes beatings by these niggers because you're at the wrong place at the wrong time, and of course, you got the wrong skin color, so it had to happen. But in spite of all this, in spite of just the glaring differences between whites, blacks, our societies, our ideals, how we conduct ourselves, anything, and this is, it's embarrassing to admit, but I fell into that egalitarian brainwashing scheme and sincerely believed for a time, oh, we all bleed red. Hitler was the devil. The South was racist and is racist. White people are the scourge of humanity. Ha, ba, 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 ba. Just every sickening thing you can just think he pushing on us, I believed. This was public schooling system, and this is what they excel at, if nothing else. And that's something I think the older generations, I guess, people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, don't really understand. And they can't. You can't understand how effectively, how masterfully they beat these ideals into our heads. But anyways, my father was a Southern he is a Southern nationalist. And when I started railing against the South for being racist, he flipped his lid. And he lent me a few books he had collected over the years. And they detailed why the South was right, the economic and political factors that led to the war between the states and secession, and how they were not all about slavery and keeping the poor black man down. And while this didn't completely set me straight, I believe it was a great primer. Because now I could see I was being lied to. And of course, you know, at first I couldn't understand how big this lie was. Who can at first? But I started down that path. And now, of course, being a 90s kid, a lot of my time was spent on the internet. You know, video games, email, message boards, what have you. And of course, the internet is where I get most of my information from. Me and every other 90s kid, everyone else in my generation. So I'm browsing around one day. I'm on this anonymous message board. I'm just looking up different topics, you know, current events, history, politics, whatever. And as I'm browsing through, I see this one particular thread that has well over 400 replies, and half of them are to one post. I thought this was pretty odd, so I wanted to go check out what was happening. And this thread, or this post, I mean, was just amazing. Studies by renowned scientists detailing racial differences, news stories that were completely covered up because the victim was white and the perpetrator was black, of course. How the spiritual cancer that seems to be on our society, feminism, liberalism, if you can even call it that, leftism, seems that there was always a Jew somewhere either financing it or heading these groups. Always. And needless to say, this blew my mind. I'm sitting here reading through this going, there is just no way. Well, of course, I'm double checking and checking, and it all turns out right. And it's just, it was horrifying at first. I mean, it was exciting because, oh, wow, big secret, but it was horrifying. The veil had been pulled away. But one thing that caught my eye more than anything was at the very bottom of this post, of all this information, was the phrase, "It's time to come home, white man," and a link to the Northwest Front website. This was more interesting to me than the actual information, believe it or not, and so I went to the website. I read through maybe a paragraph before that old knee-jerk reaction kicked in, and I thought, oh, a white homeland, how racist, how evil, and I closed out the window. I didn't think about it for a month. But in that month, that seed took root. I had to know more. So about a month or two later, I contacted the Northwest Front, and I got the white book and a few copies of The Observer. And with this, the floodgates were just opened. I read through the white book. I made use of the recommended reading section in the very back. And before you knew it, I had the Northwest novels, you know, The Brigade First, which is an excellent primer, I believe. The Brigade, I had essays and speeches by John C. Calhoun, I had Republic by Plato, I had The White Power by George Lincoln Rockwell, and eventually even Mein Kampf sent to my house. And I began reading these, and of course that led me to read more on Aryan history and culture and literature in general. And this woke me up. It made me who I am today. And for that, I'm grateful. And if there's one thing I want the listeners to come away with from this, is that you need to spread the message as much as you can. Some anonymous poster on a message board woke me up, or began the process of waking me up. And I gained back my ability to think. And that saved me. Brothers and sisters, I can't stress this enough. Spread the message. Your efforts yield results. Now, I'm 7 minutes in, and I think dragging this out pretty bad. But again, thank you for listening. Thank you, Harold, and whoever else, for listening to our awakening experiences and letting others know that we're out there. They're not alone. There are others out there. Hail victory, comrades.
Greetings, comrades. This is Comrade Adam from Portland
area.
You hear that in the background? That's the sound of the Oregon coast, because I'm down here on spring break, surrounded by white people, for the most part. I just thought this would be an interesting tidbit to let you guys know that there are still a lot of white people out here in the Northwest, especially down here on the coast around good weather times like this. So it might be kind of enjoyable to come up here and join us. And if you feel like you don't have a permission slip, you do. It's called the Butler Plan. So see you guys in whenever the hell you get here.
Greetings, comrade. This is Comrade Adam coming at you live from Rockaway Beach, Oregon, just north of Tillamook. Guess what I did today, guys? I went and checked out some of our local museums, specifically the County Museum and the Maritime Museum in the city of Garibaldi, just north of Tillamook in the bay. And yeah, it's been a pretty great spring break. We've gotten a little bit of sun. Everybody's pretty much white up here, so there's that too. And you want to hear what's in the background? That's the North Oregon coast. Yep, that's our North Pacific Ocean. Pretty great, full of delicious sea creatures like Dungeness crab, Chinook salmon, and various other species that is almost too long to list. Not to mention we got gray whales and whatnot migrating up through here. I could go into greater detail in that if anybody wants to know anything more about wildlife in the area. But we also got elk and cougars and all other sorts of fun, delightful creatures for you to hunt. So if you're into hunting, come up here. We got plenty of game for you. Yeah, so it's pretty great up here. Why not come up here? You have the Butler Plan. That's your pass to do this. Come on, let's go.
Okay, time for another one of those rock and roll or black metal pieces that keep coming in over the transom here. This is from a young man called Jason in Milwaukee who sent this in. The group is called Legacy of Blood, and the title track is Call of Blood. And Jason thinks it's bloody good. See if you agree.
And so
Okay, that last number took a little bit longer than I thought, so I don't really have the time to get into this one new topic I keep meaning to bring up on the show, and it looks like I'll just have to wait until next week for that, so I guess I'll go ahead and just keep on jamming my foot in my mouth and getting into all kinds of trouble over the women thing. If I had to pick the absolute worst thing that the Jews have done to us, I would say that they have driven a now almost insurmountable wedge between white women and white men. Nowhere else is the clearly genocidal and anti-human nature of Judaism more apparent. Nothing else has caused more suffering, anguish, disruption to Western civilization, or loss to the world Aryan gene pool than the creation of a society where white men and women view one another as adversaries instead of partners. The instigation and propagation of this hatred between white men and women is the Jews' greatest success story, possibly in the long run a greater victory for Zionism than the destruction of the Third Reich or the creation of the artificial criminal state of Israel. Because when white men and women hate one another, the number of white babies born drops like a stone and we get closer and closer to that point of no return where our racial extinction becomes inevitable. And always bear in mind that this is the ultimate goal of the Jewish people, to exterminate every man and every woman with a white skin from the face of the earth. This topic is important, as I've stated before. Now, unlike religion, it is solvable if we can somehow reacquire the art of thinking instead of feeling, and thinking right at that. And unlike religion, it must be thrashed out and solved now. Not put aside for the time after the revolution when we have power. Now, I've been asked on occasion where the famous expression Vive la Difference came from. I understand it happened something like this. In the late 1890s, France was considering giving women the vote, and some famous French feminist, whose name I can't recall, was given the honor, almost unique for a woman at that time, of addressing the National Assembly in full session, all male, of course, and all of whom sat there attired in their full formal dress suits with the white gloves and the wide shoulder sashes and the decorations and the top hats and other such 1890s politicians' fripperies. The lady was up on the podium haranguing them with her feminist rap, which was listened to in polite silence. She concluded her speech with, "Really, messieurs, you must acknowledge that when one comes right down to it, there is very little difference between men and women." And at this remark, the entire French Chamber of Deputies spontaneously rose to its feet as one man and shouted out, "Vive la différence!" And that's pretty much it. Men and women are different, not inherently inferior or superior to one another, but different. To say that one sex is in any way inferior or superior to another is like saying that apples are inferior to oranges or vice versa. They're two different fruits, and any such comments are a matter of personal taste and outlook, not scientific or pragmatic fact. To say that an apple is in some way, quote-unquote, better or worse than an orange has no relevance or meaning in the real world. The differences between men and women are, in my opinion, about 80% biological and genetic and biochemical, and therefore inalterable, and maybe 20% environmental and psychological, that 20% being subject to a certain limited degree of possible manipulation and alteration, but by no means as much as the feminists would like to have us believe. It's therefore pointless and absurd to try and create in men and women two quote-unquote equal humanoid organisms. It can't be done. Men, on the whole, are physically larger and stronger than women, or they used to be before American white boys became such wusses and dweebs, and they still are in natural societies of all races. Yes, there are individual exceptions in today's politically correct culture as white males degenerate into Dilbert-esque cubicle dwellers, and women become more masculine in character, which seems to somewhat augment their physical size, or maybe that's just all the Oreos and ice cream women stuff into their mouths when they're depressed and upset. Now, one of the most sinister developments in recent years have been several statistical surveys and studies indicating that sedentary American white males are actually losing their virility in the physical as well as the moral sense. White sperm counts have been dropping for almost 20 years. We are becoming less than men in every sense of the word. But in all non-yuppie, more or less organic societies of all races, men as a rule are the larger and the stronger. Some of this has to do with diet. In any business or work environment where there are large numbers of illegal aliens, for example, compare the size of Orientals who were born and raised in China or Southeast Asia on nothing but rice and a little fish, with the size and weight of Asian Americans who were born here and who grew up on plenty of fruits, grains, vegetables, and good old-fashioned cholesterol-packed meat. Native-born Chinese women especially are tiny things, between 70 and 80 pounds, although actually they're stronger than white American valley girls due to having been forced into manual labor from birth. But most of these exceptions are individual, culture-specific, or otherwise idiosyncratic. Men are physically bigger and stronger than women. Now, this is because nature has given human men and women a natural division of labor, which cannot be repealed by feminism, by affirmative action, or by anything else. That natural division is simple. The man provides the food, the shelter, and the protection from enemies for the family unit. The woman bears and raises the children. This is how human beings are supposed to live. Indeed, the only way they can live past a couple of confused and chaotic generations of the kind we're experiencing now. It is innate. It is biological. It cannot be changed. And any attempt to tamper with it produces disaster and destruction, as we are now learning in politically correct America. No baby creatures are more helpless than human infants. Snakes and alligators are self-sufficient from the time they hatch. Birds and kittens and puppies are up and functioning and providing their own food in a matter of weeks. Human babies must be fed initially by a mother's milk for a period of months, and then on specially treated and prepared food for another year or so, until they get all their teeth in. They cannot defend themselves or escape from an enemy unaided. Children can't really live on their own with any hope of survival for the first 10 or 11 years of life. The whole traditional nuclear family, so hated and railed at by liberals and feminists, is an institution ordained by God or the gods or nature or the force or the great pumpkin or whatever to make sure that the human species continues to exist. The primary purpose of the man-woman relationship is to produce children and care for them until they are adult enough to fend for themselves. The emotional and cultural side benefits to marriage are valuable, and they've produced our whole civilization, but they are, in fact, incidental byproducts of the central process of continuing the human species. The father and the mother are not the most vital part of the picture, although they are essential. The children are. This arrangement is not unknown in other species, and in all mammals at any rate, the male is almost always larger, stronger, faster, and more combative. In many cases, such as lions and wolves, one alpha male practices polygamy with a number of females and kills off other male competitors until he grows old and weak and is in turn killed off by a younger male. Primitive non-white societies in Africa and the Third World still follow this pattern. Aryans, for the most part, have generally mated for life down through the years. Now, there are some records of polygamy in ancient Aryan cultures, but not as many as elsewhere. The ancient Norse and Germans practiced it for a while, but gave it up about the turn of the last millennium. For good or for ill, once the Aryan race became Christianized, polygamy vanished. Anyway, I owe you guys a third music break about now, so here's a song for you ladies out there. This is Tommy Makem and Liam Clancy, showing the world how real white men have always felt about our women.
Come over the hills, my bonny Irish lass. Come over the hills to your darling. You choose the road, love, and I'll make the vow. And I'll be your true love forever. Where is the rose that in yonder garden grows? Fair is the lily of the valley. Clear is the water that flows from the boy. But my love is fairer. Down by Killarney's green woods that we strayed, on the moon and the stars they were shining. The moon shone its rays on our locks of golden hair. she swore she'd be my love forever. Red is the rose that in yonder garden grows. Fair is the lily of the valley. Clear is the water that flows from the point where my love is fairer than any. 'Tis not for the parting with my sister Kate, 'tis not for the grief of my mother, 'tis all for the loss of my bonny Irish lass, that my heart is breaking forever. Red is the rose that in yonder garden grows. Fair is the lily of the valley. Clear is the water that flows from the boy. But my love is fairer than
men and women are two halves of a whole. Neither can or should exist without the other. The idea of two halves of the same organism competing with one another, dominating one another, or existing in enmity with one another is an obvious recipe for destruction. Now, this is why the Jews promote the idea that men are some kind of natural enemy to women, as they promote any and all things which are destructive and poisonous and breed confusion and unhappiness among our people. They hate us and want us all dead, and they use every weapon they can to bring this about, including feminism. Quite simple, really. Homosexuality is a loathsome perversion. It is absolutely and utterly wrong because it denies the natural division of labor between man and woman, and because it precludes the production of children. The instinctive loathing that the overwhelming majority of normal people feel even today for faggots and dykes is an inner recognition on the part of our genetic makeup, or souls if you're a Christian, that what is going on is unnatural and counter-survival, or sinful. Millions of years of genetic codes triggering biological survival behavior cannot be overwritten by 50 years of Hollywood propaganda or suppressed by hate speech laws. The Northwest Republic will recreate a world based on natural order, and that most specifically includes a return to what are referred to as traditional family values, with the gainfully employed father as the head of the family, and the full-time mother and homemaker as the family's heart. This does not in any way involve enslaving women. In a very real sense, it liberates them from feminism and Judaic values, and the true slavery of the economic marketplace. The female citizens and residents of the Northwest Republic will have a freedom which they have all but lost today. The freedom to be real women. Well, for now our time is up on this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.